Hello everyone and welcome to our sixth episode at Ruby India. Ruby India brings together curated content from and for the Ruby Indian community and friends. We do a regular newsletter highlighting content from the people in the community. One of the aims is to highlight people and their work, which has led to start with a podcast. Today, I am in San Francisco in the Ninefold office with Sarah. First of all, thanks to Ninefold for giving us space over here so we could go with this podcast. I'll hand it over to Sarah, who could introduce herself a bit.
My name is Sarah Allen. I go by Ultrasaurus on Twitter and all the things. And I've been doing product development for over 20 years, and for the last 10 years, a lot of open source work and a lot of community work.
Yep. And where did you, how many years have you been working for?
I started, my first full-time job out of college was in 1990.
And where was it like?
I graduated from college in Providence, Rhode Island. I went to Brown University and got a CS degree and a visual art degree. And my first job was a startup that I joined. I was first just going to join for the summer. And then it became a thing, and with a bunch of guys that I went to college with, and somebody who had graduated a few years before us. And that company is most famous for having created After Effects. And the company was then bought by Aldus, if you remember them, big makers of PageMaker. Yeah. And then Aldus was acquired by Adobe.
So I went through and I saw that you've worked a lot on a lot of things which Adobe works on, like Flash and all, like After Effects, you've said. How was your experience with that?
Well, it was definitely exciting to be, sort of go on through the internet boom. I left Adobe in 95 to join Macromedia and joined this project that was then codenamed Shockwave. And I wanted to learn about the internet. And that was a good time to be learning about the internet.
You got to create all the exciting things that everyone knows about.
Yes, although it was a little controversial at the time. There were people who in 1995 thought images were a bad idea on the internet, and that maybe we were going to break the internet by bringing multimedia to it. But it was very exciting to to be one of the, I think we were the first Netscape plugin, because we were able to use the plugin API when it was beta, right when Netscape 2 was coming out. And to kind of see all of these projects emerge was very, very exciting. Of course, we went from being this strange corner of the building and of the industry where most people at Macromedia didn't even really, they couldn't access the internet, they didn't know we had a website. We would go to demo Shockwave. I remember going to companies to demo Shockwave, and they wouldn't have a modem. And the phones in the offices wouldn't, they were these office phones. So it was really challenging to demo because not everybody had an internet connection. And then just a couple years later, everybody, there were billboards, everybody was on the internet, and it was a thing. So that was a really interesting transformation.
And when did you get started with Ruby? How did you get introduced to Ruby?
So I left my previous company before I got involved with Ruby was a company called Laszlo Systems, which is where I really learned about open source. Mm-hmm. And I decided to go out on my own for 1 year and do consulting for the first time in my life and let the projects determine the technology that I would learn.
So before we proceed, Laszlo and a bit about it.
So Laszlo Systems created a, we used to say it was open source, asynchronous JavaScript before it was cool. We had an open source JavaScript framework that was released in the early 2000s called OpenLaszlo. And it was XML markup and JavaScript that let you do desktop-like applications on the web. So I was a JavaScript expert. I had never really done that much server-side. I always worked in the context of server stuff. Did a little bit of Java, a little bit of this and that. So I was going into kind of a position of strength on the client side because JavaScript and the Flash video stuff was very popular. Which I knew very well. And then I wasn't sure what I wanted to learn. There were so many things to learn. Like, it was so exciting. Did I want to do Ruby? Did I want to do Python? Did I want to do Skype plugins? Because I was still really into audio video stuff. There was also, you know, this emerging real time.
Skype plugins?
Yeah, because Skype had just released a plugin API, and this was like 2008. Which I didn't end up doing. But the first, I ended up meeting the original founders of Mightyverse through, because they were users of After Effects. And they knew my buddies who were still involved with After Effects, and they were looking for a CTO. But I wanted to work with somebody first before considering that. So I did a consulting gig with them. And I was going to do some front-end JavaScript and video stuff, and their back-end was Ruby on Rails. So I said, I can learn this. I can learn anything. And so at home, in my home office, I taught myself Ruby on Rails.
2008.
So it was, the app was Rails 2.1, and I upgraded it to 2.2. And... it was a bit of an adventure because, as you may know, it's...
2.3 was tough. That's what I think.
Well, what was really challenging about it is they had done internationalization before it was a feature.
Yeah.
So there was this globalized plugin that had been sort of intertwined into the innards of the app in a way that was... wasn't simpatico with the new architecture. So that took a little unwinding. And I ended up hiring somebody to pair with me. So I hired this guy, Wolfram Arnold, who I found off Craigslist. And we paired together. And that was what really, really solidified my understanding of Rails.
I'm sorry, what? Who?
His name's Wolfram Arnold. He works at Twitter now, but he consulted for a long time. And I really wanted to do test-driven development, and he was an expert in that and in coding, in Ruby on Rails. And so I taught myself Ruby, and I taught myself Rails. I quickly learned that you really, really need to know Ruby well in order to be a reasonably good Rails developer. And because at the very beginning, it was just very hard to tease apart, like really understanding what was idiomatic when we were in this strange transition of, you know, Rails versions and whatnot. So it was really helpful pairing with an expert.
You've also been involved in a lot of community events like RailsBridge. Maybe you can speak more about those.
Yeah, so I had been teaching myself Ruby on Rails, and I'd been pairing with Wolf, and I started going to Ruby meetups. And the first Ruby meetup I went to had 70 people. And
this was in San Francisco?
Yes, it was a San Francisco Ruby meetup. There were 70 people. There was one other woman there who I introduced myself to. It was a funny meetup because Chris Wanstroth was presenting some new GitHub features. They had just done those graphs that with the network graphs and so forth and the bubble graphs. And at the beginning of his talk, he said, "Who doesn't use GitHub?" And I'd never heard of it, right? So I raised my hand, and he looks at me and he says, "Why not?" I was completely taken aback. I had no idea that this was, like, everybody in the whole Ruby community used this thing. So I just never had a reason to.
Yep.
But then, sooner than later, I was using GitHub myself. And I then went to go Golden Gate Ruby Conference, the very first one, and met Sarah May again, and realized that the Ruby community, at least as evidenced by its events, had a very small percentage of women. And I had been, like I said, Ruby was one of the languages that I was interested in for years before I ever sort of made the time to learn it. And I really made the time to learn it based on having a reason to. And I thought there's probably a lot of women like me who, just given a reason to, would learn Ruby and maybe bring it to their workplace or have it be their next thing. So we came up with this idea of just having a little workshop. And we originally think it would be like 5 or 10 women. And we teach this every month. And then at the end of the year, if 10% of the people stuck around, we would increase the number of women at this conference by a factor of 3. We wanted to triple the number of women at the conference and get to 20%. So so we thought it would be really hard to find people. And we brainstormed this a lot, and we had a whole plan of outreach. And then when we finally posted the event, we figured at its maximum, we could each teach a class of 20. So we set that as the maximum, and we posted the event, and in less than 24 hours, we had a waiting list, just from each of us tweeting about it and posting on one mailing list. So we quickly... This was Rails Bridge. This was the very first Rails Bridge workshop. Because basically we found that there was a huge number of people interested in Rails and Ruby, and that unlike the mythology of the day, which was that, you know, there were people who would be like, well, maybe women just aren't into programming. We quickly showed that demand was not a problem, that there is, in fact, this thirst for it. And if you're not in a social scene where there are a lot of programmers, which most women aren't, it's, you know, it's a hard entry point. Most people have a story. I mean, there's always somebody who's like, I learned it from a book in my basement by myself. But most people these days have a social experience. They learn it from a friend.
And so after that, you also did Bridge Foundry.
Yeah, so what basically we did that, we had this whole plan that we were going to do a series of workshops and they were going to, you know, level up and get involved in open source. And those first workshops were just so, so popular that it was all we could do to build this volunteer base who would keep putting on the same workshop. And the organization grew tremendously, doubling every year. And what... We had these other projects that were not the Rails workshops. And there were other technologies interested in who kept borrowing the model. So we had, there was like two different Python groups that kind of borrowed the Rails Bridge model. The Boston Python workshops was probably the first one. And then, and the closer languages didn't want to call themselves Rails Bridge, because it was Rails.
Yeah.
And so we basically refactored out the non-Rails workshop part of things, and that's called Bridge Foundry. But basically what we saw is by having these events, the community really opened up. Guys started having more, like more meetups. The people seemed more willing to open up and ask questions. There was much more of an openness to kind of opportunities at different levels for people to get involved.
And then also Rails Girls came in afterwards?
Well, the Rails Girls was actually, there were these two women from Helsinki, I think, who came to a workshop at EngineYard that Sarah May was at.
Okay.
And they decided to bring it back home, and they had a twist on it, where they wanted to focus on, initially it was, I think, teenage girls who would then do whatever, a project of their choosing over a weekend with the mentorship of people there. And that was their initial format. And so they wanted a very different format. And so they started a different group to do that. And then, and that has evolved and spread all over the world. And generally we welcome anything that people want to do is great. And that we decidedly made our materials open source so that people could riff on them. We didn't want to gate it in any way.
Right. Actually, we also have, like, we had 3 events of Rails Girls, so it's been pretty amazing. Like, it's reached a lot more far from San Francisco. Moving ahead, like, what all, like, you've worked on a lot of things, you know, from... right from Open Laszlo to being involved in a lot of projects, like what all exciting things that you have seen or done in the open source world?
So many things.
In Ruby?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I haven't been involved in really big open source projects. I actually really love the little projects. I think that smaller projects are a way to really kind of get to know a community and make your mark or help other people. I think the learning opportunity through open source is the kind of a magical thing. I helped start what we call Bridge Troll, which is the registration system. And that was really, you know, it hobbled along, you know, in really, at the beginning, we really tried to prioritize that as a learning platform, which it ended up making it really hard to get traction in terms of it being a production platform. And Lily Chilane and Travis really kind of took it to another level and made it a very active open source project. And I've really enjoyed kind of coming back and contributing to it and being just one of the many contributors to it. And so that's a project that I've really enjoyed. More recently, I've been doing some Ruby programming around an open source project, which is really very new. I'm doing a research project with the Smithsonian around connecting archival data about people. And so there's this EAC format, which is encoded archival context. And I've just started a little gem for it. And because I really like the, you know, making gems and having this code that's decoupled from other code, and the fine folks who work in archives sometimes don't have either the background or the interest in making awesome code, right? And I'm not saying that this is necessarily awesome code yet, but I aspire to create some tools that the digital humanities folks would be able to use without being technology experts.
I also saw you were involved in Radiant CMS.
I was for a little while. When I was running Blazing Cloud, one of our first big projects was doing a CMS for, and the whole front end site for the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. And we picked Radiant as a CMS and contributed to it a little bit at that time. And it was really, I really aspired for Ruby to have a great CMS, and I think that Radiant was a really good option at that time. I think that there are a lot of really good ideas in Radiant, but I think one of the challenging things is that Rails has a habit of breaking the CMSs every time there's a new release, which I think, you know, for one or two releases is totally understandable. But I think at some point, one might imagine that that use case should be considered in such a way that there would be a reasonable pattern that people could follow, which wouldn't automatically be broken in the next release. So I think that that's just a really big challenge of our community, that we don't really have the tooling around that I'd like to see.
Moving on to, like, you've worked at a lot of places, but right now and in the past 5 or 6 years, you've been in, would like to speak about those companies like the Smithsonian Institution you've worked. You were a presidential fellow. You work for 18F, Mightyverse. So a bit about those things.
So yes, Mightyverse, I've been working part-time for the last 5 or 6 years, and that's really a labor of love. We've got a Rails app. We've also done some iOS apps, and we have a new iOS app that's in development. But I found that Ruby has been a really great platform for evolving that app over time as we work on really understanding learning models. So it's about human spoken language. And we have this idea of building a crowdsourced platform where people can submit recordings of them saying one phrase that then gets cross-translated into another language. And to build something that's really organic like that, I think requires software to evolve over time with a community. And I've really enjoyed using Ruby for that attribute of having something flexible.
What all things does it use in behind the scenes?
So it's right now it's Rails 3.2. I just upgraded to Ruby 2 and the latest version of RSpec in anticipation of a Rails upgrade. I use Devise and OmniAuth and Postgres, and then Memcache on the for caching.
Is it doing a lot of audio processing, like you said? It's just storing all those audios.
So yeah, it's just storing them. We have a model of translation that's really just in the relational database, and all the translation is done by humans. So the little video snippets are stored in S3.
Okay. And then going back to the work you're doing right now.
So I work for 18F, that's 18F, which is a new group inside our federal government. So it's, I never expected to be a federal employee. Working for the U.S. government is not... It's not really considered to be a forward-thinking digital services place in the U.S., but that's changing. So we have, in this administration, we had our first ever Chief Technology Officer of the United States. And the White House has really taken some steps to make it so that so that people can do agile within the government, that people can really deliver services in ways that are more forward-thinking. And I'm very, very excited about the executive order from last year where President Obama signed this this executive order that says that all data that we pay for with our tax dollars, if it doesn't have personally identifiable information or it's not top secret for some reason, by default, it needs to be open. Mm-hmm. And we've had huge precedent in the United States for having government open data stimulate the economy. With GPS, with weather data before that, it has just been really phenomenal for our country. So I'm really excited about that happening more so.
At the Goguruku speaker dinner party, you showed me a game that you have been working on. Maybe you can tell us more about like how you actually got involved in the game development and like what all things did you do when you were developing that game?
So this is a card game called Dígame, which means tell me in Spanish. And so this came out of...
It's
a board game with cards. And yes, it's a physical game outside of software computers. There's no Ruby simulation. So this came out of, after I finished the Smithsonian, I was at the Smithsonian last year for 6 months, completely focused on something very, very different than I'd done before. It was similar in theme to Mightyverse because it was crowdsourcing, but it was crowdsourcing people transcribing archival documents. But I did a lot of research about crowdsourcing, and I did a lot of thinking about what is it that I'm really best at and what do I bring to a group. And I really felt that if I'm going to do Mightyverse, I want to do my best work. I want to follow best practices. They say sometimes that we have an expression, the cobbler's children have no shoes, which is that sometimes your own projects suffer. And I'd done that with Mightyverse. You know, there's like some rough edges there, definitely. And I think that in the early days of the startup, that was appropriate to kind of validate where we were going with the software. But I felt like, okay, now the way to validate our idea is to build a really nice version of it. So I came back from the Smithsonian in December and started designing this new app that would allow you to do this crowdsourcing, and it would have a back end, and the front end would be a mobile device, and you'd be able to record these little phrases. And we were going to do a crowdfunding campaign for that apps, and then I would take off time and work on it full time, funded by this crowdfunding campaign. And in the design of this app, we wanted to make it really fun. I believe that language learning is intrinsically fun. Yeah. But I'd never designed a game before. I've done platforms for designing games, you know. Shockwave and Flash were probably the majority of people use them for writing games. But that's very different from creating a game from scratch myself. So Me and my colleagues watched a lot of videos and read up on game design, and we actually saw that one of the videos that one of my colleagues sent me was about board game design. And I was like, nah, this is kind of academic. It's only loosely related to a mobile app. But then after we'd done a design session, I said, okay, the next step is for us to do a paper prototype. We are going to do a paper prototype, and we're going to get a group of people together who are language learners, and we're going to make them play our game on paper, as stupid as it seems and as weird as it is. That's what we're going to do. So we started designing this paper prototype, and we ended up creating something that was this card game, and we realized that it ended up only needing one speaker of the language. So we realized you could play it in a classroom setting. So we decided to do a mini crowdfunding campaign just to produce this card game so that we would be recruiting our potential future customers and have a way to really hone our marketing message around the core idea, which is to have fun learning a language, and start by watching people play this card game and then evolve that into a mobile app. So we built out this whole card game that we just sent to the printer, and it's like, you know, there's real cards and a board, and it was so fun and unbelievably hard. But at the beginning, it was just so hard to invite random people to play my card game. I felt so weird about it because you know, I seem like a really outgoing person, but that doesn't mean that I'm totally comfortable just getting some random people to, like, play with my index cards.
But we played. We did not. Yeah.
But I did. Like, I've gotten so used to it that I haul it out at the speaker's dinner because now I'm so excited to share it. But yeah, now I have confidence that, you know, that it works, and, you know, I've blind tested it and so forth.
Nice. So this, again, going back to like the software world, we would like to know what kind of, in your day-to-day programming, what all different tools do you use, maybe for Ruby development or for JavaScript, in general and for programming?
So I use RubyMine for Rails. I use MacVim for just about everything else. I don't know what tools I use. So, you know, it's all like the terminal and various gems. But yeah, and GitHub, I'm a big fan of. I find that what I do, which I'm surprised more people don't do, is when I'm learning something, I do it in an isolated app, I post it on GitHub, and I write a blog post about it. And what I find then is people will, you know, people very rarely comment on my blog, but every once in a while I'll get a comment that teaches me something. And sometimes it's about something I did years ago, and then I get automatic updates about, like, oh, things have changed in this world. So I think that discipline of kind of being public about the stuff you're learning, it's hard to be vulnerable that way sometimes because you want to come off as, like, you know what you're doing, but I think it's really important.
This is something that we ask generally to a lot of people, because every once in a while we speak about what all things we use, but not about what our company uses. So, what all things do you use at your company? Companies, like at the government, you've doing work at Mightyverse or before this in consulting. In terms of communication or workflow and all those things?
So right now in my government team, we're using Slack, which I love. I can't believe that I love it so much, but I do. It has just a really nice flow. And then we have it hooked up to GitHub, so I have like a channel for my project, and then anytime anybody does anything in GitHub, it posts it to the channel. So I really surprisingly love that. And the other thing we do at our company, which I think is kind of neat, is we have a lot of approvals we have to go through for blog posts, but we want to be very transparent because that's part of our gig.
Yeah.
So what we have is we have a private repository for blog drafts.
Okay.
And then we have a little workflow where anybody can start a draft on any idea they have, and other people can chime in. So you can like listen to the whole repo, and then you know when anybody comes up with a blog idea. And then you kind of, whoever wants to chimes in, and then when you get to a certain place, you tag somebody who's responsible for approving it. So this is on GitHub. It's its own, yeah, it's basically our group blog. And then what we used to do is...
The Lighthouse blog?
It's the 18F blog.
Okay.
This would be very cool if it was the White House blog, but I think, I don't know what they use. But yeah, what we used to do is in the final, like then it would be sent to like the communication department who approves it, and then we would put it on Tumblr. But now we're moving our blog to Jekyll. So we'll be able to go straight from Markdown in GitHub to Markdown Jekyll, which I'm pretty excited about. So I really like that. For my open source project, I use GitHub Issues, which drives me crazy because I hate that you have to put things in buckets instead of doing linear priorities. I love Pivotal Tracker. There's things I don't love about it, but I love the discipline of having to prioritize everything linearly. So I use that for Mightyverse, and I used it at Blazing Cloud. The other thing is I always have continuous integration for all of my projects. I think that without doing that, it's a waste of time. So I'm a big fan of Hudson, which is a Java app, but I think it works really well. Although for all my open source projects, I use Travis.
Okay, you use Hudson for CI.
For CI. Yeah, so we had a setup at Blazing Cloud where we would have a hosted Hudson on Amazon, and then we would run all of our different projects there, and then we'd have like an iPad where we could see which ones were red and green. So it's really nice to have like in your office to have a big monitor where you can see things, whether things are red or green.
Yep, that's about it. Like all the questions I had. In closing, would you like to like speak a bit about? The importance of being involved in the community or the community events or just being involved in the open source world?
Well, yeah, I think that more and more the infrastructure that we're using is open source.
Yes.
And when that's true, it has an incredibly positive attribute for us as developers. But more than that, I remember meeting Rob Savoy once, who was one of the founding members of the EFF, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. And he said that everything that he ever did, with rare exception, was open source. So that any project he wanted to do in the future, he could use anything he'd ever worked on. And I thought to myself, what if I just had in my back pocket all of the code that I'd ever written on After Effects, Shockwave, and Flash Video, what I could do? And we, as developers, have to rewrite things over and over and over again when we live in that proprietary world. And I think that, you know, life's short, that we should be focused on things that haven't been done before. And we should share all the boilerplate stuff that we've written 1,000 times.
And also about the events.
Yeah, I think that, I think everybody should think about ways that they give back. Because we get so much from the community. And the biggest thing is I think that the best way to learn is to teach, to share what you know. And the best way to get started is with the small community events, like to speak at a meetup, to participate in small ways, to join a hackathon, to have an open source hack night. One of the events that's easiest to organize that we do periodically in San Francisco is just to have a night where everybody just comes and they work on their projects. And that's just a very kind of low barrier way to get involved. And people can bring their own projects and, you know, sort of share stories and share tips.
Yep. With that, like, we are done with the time. Thanks a lot, Sarah. Thanks for being, like, making the time and making available like the Nineful Office, the space for helping us out over here. Thanks again.
Thank you.